As I looked at Psalm 39, it was very daunting to me. It has taken a lot of time to think, what can I even preach about on this psalm? I'm reminded of the passage in Ecclesiastes where he says, guard your steps as you enter the house of God. Don't enter to offer the sacrifice of fools. The fool's sacrifice comes with many words, but he said, God isn't looking for many words. He's looking for you to be faithful to the truth and faithful to your word, and so don't say anything rashly. Something that I'm trying to consider as I go into this topic of how do we mortals, human beings with all of our limitations, how do we approach the immortal God, David seems to be commenting on this, and the psalm itself says is written for a guy named Jeduthun. Jeduthun was one of the song leaders at the tabernacle in David's day. There were three of them. And so I suspect that Jeduthun is the same as the concert master, chief musician, or choir director, music director that David also mentions as a title at the beginning of Psalm 39. And that this is, Jeduthun is probably the guy that first led this psalm in being sung and worship in the temple. Easton's Bible Dictionary notes that his name, Jeduthun, means one who gives praises, and notes that the other two guys are mentioned in a parallel passage in 1 Chronicles 15. Heman and Asaph, I believe, are the other two. Yeah, Heman and Asaph. But the third name in 1 Chronicles 15 is Ethan, the son of Cushaiah. So I think probably that is his actual name is Ethan, and his nickname as the choir leader is Jeduthun. There are two other psalms that bear his name, Psalm 62 and 77, but they use a different preposition than the one that is here in Psalm 39. I think Psalm 39 was something that Jeduthun himself led. And in the psalm, and it's entirely appropriate to have your worship leaders grapple with this whole concept of how do we, as human creatures, how relate to God, and how can we lead other people in relating to God? David grapples in the psalm with how a mortal, especially a sinner who deserves God's wrath, how we can relate to the immortal God. Some questions that he deals with is, should I try to talk to God or not? Can I find out what he's thinking? Or is he silent? Can I negotiate with him? Or do I just have to accept my fate? Whatever he does, that's just the way it'll be. And kind of overall, what should be my attitude as I approach the majesty of his presence? David wrote in Psalm 141, "Set a guard, O Lord, over my mouth. Keep watch over the door of my lips." He starts out in Psalm 39 with a personal resolution that he's just gonna keep quiet. He's not gonna talk. That way, he can't offend God by saying anything that he shouldn't. And he can't damage God's reputation by saying anything that he shouldn't. So he's just going to keep quiet. I'll keep my ways from sinning, I said, from sinning with my tongue. Let me keep a muzzle against my mouth while yet an evil person is in my presence. This is commendable. As James the Apostle said, pointed out in the New Testament, sins of the tongue are particularly pesky. And James 1:26, he said, if anyone thinks himself to be religious and yet does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is worthless. And then later on in chapter 3, the tongue is a little member, but it boasts of great things. See how great a forest is set aflame by such a little fire. And the tongue is a fire, the very world of iniquity. And the tongue is set among our members as that which defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of life and is set on fire by hell. For every kind of beast and bird, reptile, creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind, but no man can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil and full of deadly poison. However, saying nothing is not God's will. David went overboard here. And David's testimony is that it didn't work in verse 2. I was shut up motionless. I held my peace from you. Yet, my pain was stirred up. God made us to be able to communicate. He gave us innate structures of language. I was just reading an article about a group of deaf children from poor villages that had been pulled together into an orphanage, never taught to communicate, never taught sign language, and had never learned to communicate with anyone. And they were, you know, little children, 5, 6 years old, younger, and they invented their own sign language. And this linguist was examining this, and it was really cool because here was a language that had emerged suddenly among people who had not communicated in language before, and they were suddenly doing it. God hardwired that into us. It didn't evolve over years. It didn't have time to evolve with those deaf children. David says, we experience pain in our human condition. We experience sorrow, suffering. And God doesn't intend for us to bottle that up and not talk with him about it. It is a real problem. It is real suffering. It's real sorrow. Isaiah 6:5, when he realized the holiness of the God that he had been brought into the presence of, and his own sin, which made him completely disqualified to be able to be in God's presence, he said, "Woe is me, I am undone." Use the same root word that David did when he said, "I was shut up." It could also be a reflexive, I shut my mouth up too. Isaiah 2 said, I'm undone, I'm shut down. I'm a man of unclean lips, live in the midst of people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. This pain that David is experiencing is a result of sin and the consequences of sin. We're going to see that in a moment more clearly. But not communicating with God, not communicating with other people, is unhealthy. God didn't say, don't talk to the pagans, right? He said, preach the gospel to all creation. Colossians 4:5, he said, conduct yourself with wisdom toward outsiders. There's wisdom and not saying certain things when the wicked are in my presence. But in Colossians 4:5, it says, making the most of every opportunity. What opportunity? The opportunity to communicate the good news about Jesus from God's word. we're not told to keep our mouths shut. We're told to talk about the good news of Jesus. We're to make the most of opportunities he gives us to talk. Verse 3, David says, my heart heated up inside of me as a result of my meditation, these things I'm thinking about over and over again, my sin and its consequences. A fire burned. I spoke with my tongue this time. Yahweh, make known to me my end and the length of my days, what it is. I would know how gone I am. I employed a little bit of a, maybe it sounds a little bit slangy to use the word gone, but it was almost the closest to English word I could get to the same idea in Hebrew there. The word it in Hebrew is feminine. What it is then refers to the only other feminine noun in the sentence, and that's the word midat, measure, length, extent, number. What is the measurement in days of my life? this implies something here, that it is finite. What can be measured is finite, has a limit to it, has an end to it. The Apostle Peter reminds us of how finite human beings are. 1 Peter 1:24, all the glory of man is like the flower off of a plant. The plant withers, the flower drops off. There's an end to our life. In contrast, there's no end to the life of Christ or to his kingdom. Isaiah prophesied in chapter 9, verse 7, of his empire's increase and of peace, there will be no end. Same word, kits, that is used by David here, make me know my end. We are finite. We reach the end of certain spans of time. And we see changes occur. Changes in family relationships, like when you move out of your parents' house. Changes in vocation, like when your school days end and you have to get a real job. Changes in living situations, your rent lease ends, you got to move to a new place maybe. Job talked a lot about this, and I'm going to be quoting from Job a lot. This particular psalm is patterned after the wisdom literature of Job, and we also see it in Ecclesiastes, and James taps into that genre as well. I'll be quoting a lot from those other books of the Bible, the wisdom books. What is my strength? Job 6:11. What is my strength that I should wait? And what is my end that I should endure? Job 14, verse 1 and following. Man who is born of woman is short-lived and full of turmoil. Like a flower he comes forth and withers. He also flees like a shadow and does not remain. Since his days are determined, the number of his months is with thee. God knows how many months you're going to live. And his limits God has set so that he cannot pass. The Apostle Paul also talked about God setting limits to the boundaries of nations. We're finite in time and in space. God is not. We have limits or lack. We can only run so fast. When my high school track running days, I got this close to breaking the 5-minute mile, but no one's ever going to break the 1-minute mile. It's just, it's not possible. Not in a foot race, anyway. We can only have so many children. If you ever run into some woman that says she's had, she's given birth to 100 children, you probably can't trust what she's saying. We can only live so long. Somebody tells you they're 200 years old, they're probably not telling the truth. You know they're not telling the truth. David wants to know how much time is gone out of what he's got coming to him. I guess we know how much time is gone. We don't know how much time is left. I know how many birthdays I've passed. We're using up the limited time we have. We are transient, fleeting, frail. And as a result, we see that activity without a goal, an end goal to it, is wasted time. This is another kind of end, is a goal. We're goal-oriented. We need to have a sense of purpose to fill the time that we have left with meaningful activity. What is that purpose? Moses concluded in Psalm 90, here's another one of the wisdom psalms, this one written by Moses, Psalm 90, verse 12, "Teach us to number our days that we may present to you a heart of wisdom." There's a goal to present our hearts to God, to present wise hearts to God. Verse 5 and Psalm 39, back to Psalm 39. He says, "Look, it is handbreadths that you gave my days to be, and my lifetime is like nothing in comparison with you. In fact, every man taking his stand is totally puny." The grammatical construction of verse 5 emphasizes that word, handbreadths. These little measurements, four fingers wide, being dispensed by God to man to make up man's little world. A lifetime, something like 80 years. But you compare 80 years to billions, trillions of years, eternity, an infinite number, 80 years becomes vanishingly small in perspective to what God experiences. Psalm 144:4, "Man is a mere breath, his days are a passing shadow." Ecclesiastes 6:12, "Who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime, during the few years of his futile life? He'll spend them like a shadow. For who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun?" The second half of verse 5, the end of it, the second sentence there in verse 5, pictures puny little people. I think of a 5-7-year-old boy setting up a bunch of paper soldiers, or maybe you've seen this, you know, setting up the little playing pieces on a Risk game board, setting them up really carefully, and then all of a sudden it's time for the war, and he goes whoosh, or and you know, all the little pieces of paper fall down and scatter everywhere. Because these little playing pieces are totally insubstantial. There's no more substance to them than the air that is breathing. That's the picture that I get as I read that verse in Hebrew. At their best state, they're vanity, air, nothingness. We're going to see that word, hebel. Vanity, mere breath, insubstantial being. Again, in verses 6 and 11, this is a theme. The vanity or the insubstantialness or the puniness of humans in comparison to God. Let me add, however, this is not a commentary on the worth of human life. God created human life. God called it good. God made us in his image, giving something valuable to us. Human life is valuable. This is not saying human life is not valuable. The point of this psalm is that the human life is, in comparison to God, very puny. And therefore, we need to be very respectful of God instead of arrogant, acting like we are God or something. Verse 6, "In fact, it is with an image that man conducts himself. They make a roar that is just puny. He collects things, but doesn't know who will get them." I see in verse 6 three more reasons to be humble before God that are brought out. First, the Hebrew text says that humans conduct themselves betzelem. Tzelem is an image, and b is with, or in, or alongside. An image is a derived figure. It's not the original. And I think that is key to the meaning of what's going on here. An image is derived. It's not the original. We were made in the image of God. That means we are not gods. There's a God, and we are derivative of Him, and so we are not gods ourselves. We're made in the image of God. We're creatures of His. That doesn't make us insignificant, but it doesn't make us God. Furthermore, we concern ourselves so often with other things that are also not substantial, but mere images, derivatives. For instance, how much time do we spend looking at pictures on news, sales sites, advertisements, movies, books, magazines, smartphones? All of those things that we're looking at are not real. We're not looking at people. We're looking at images of people. It's so easy to get wrapped up, sucked into the preoccupation with the images and lose touch with the real. But even those things that are real, our fellow human beings, are still derivatives of the image of God. He is the ultimate reality that we should be relating to. Our focus should not be on the derivatives, but on the original, on God Himself. We seek, how much time do we spend creating an image? Working on our hair, getting dressed in the most fashionable way, focusing on how we communicate our reputation or our strengths, the way our social media profile looks. We obsess over creating an image that other people will like or respect. And that's the King James translates that, vain show. Verily, mankind walketh in a vain show, and his best estate is vanity, is the way the King James translates verse 6. Other translations render the word image as a shadow or a phantom, making it a synonym with that vanity or mere breath or puniness that was in the previous verse. We're the shadow, but God is both the light and the solid body that casts the shadow. Compared with the original substantialness of God Himself, our existence is nothing to parade around. God is the one that should get the glory. The second Hebrew word in verse 6 that gives a second reason to be humble before God is a repetition from verse 5. It's that word hebel, vain, puny, nothingness. And the picture I get as reading this in Hebrew was, it's like you've got a close-up image of a crowd roaring, and then the zoom is pulled back, and suddenly you see, oh, that's actually just a few people, and it's really not that loud, actually. Our grand schemes and great commotions and bustling about making an uproar is really nothing more than a tempest in a teapot to God. We think it's a big deal, but we humans aren't even capable of accomplishing anything that's a big deal in God's perspective. We make all the noise we want, but it's not going to make much eternal significance. We can feel all the turmoil we want. It's not going to do anything either. He is disquieted in vain, says in the King James Version. The third reason I see is to be humble before God is at the end of verse 6, we're not the final actors in history. The writer of Ecclesiastes talked about this at length in chapter 2, verse 18. He said, I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And then later on, verse 21, when there is a man who has labored with wisdom and knowledge and skill, then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them. This too is vanity and a great evil. Later on in chapter 4, he says, talks about a man who didn't have a son or a brother or an heir, yet there was no end to all his labor. His eyes were not satisfied with riches. He never asked, for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? This too is vanity and grief, he said. Reminds me of Jesus' parable of the farmer in Luke 12:20. He kept building bigger and bigger barns, and then God said, you fool, tonight your soul is required of you. All the work he had done, no benefit to him. And now, who will own what you have prepared? So for these three reasons, who we are as image bearers, not gods, what we can do with our vain and puny powers compared with God's, and the fact that none of us are around for very long, mean that we should be respectfully humble before God. The Apostle James put it this way. He said, let the rich man glory in his humiliation. Humble. Be humble. And count it a good thing. Because like flowering grass, he will pass away. For the sun rises with a scorching wind and withers the grass, and its flower falls off, and the beauty of its appearance is destroyed. So too, the rich man, in the midst of his pursuits, will fade away. So what is the way out of this hopelessness? Verse 7 is the turning point in the psalm. He says, so now, what have I waited for, my master, my hope? It is for you. What are you looking forward to? What are you dreaming about? Is it, you know, the summer vacation coming up? Is it the car that you're hoping to buy? What is it that's preoccupying your thoughts? Do you ever hope that that maybe today will be the day Jesus comes back and makes everything right? Where is that in your thinking? Are there things that you're hoping for more than you're hoping for Jesus? This is our hope for Jesus to make things right and to give us his life, his eternal life, is the only way out of the hopeless situation that he has described and that is described in so many of these pieces of biblical wisdom literature. What am I waiting for? It is for you, my master, my hope. Job said, though he slay me, speaking of God, yet I will hope in him. Nevertheless, I will argue my ways before him. He's going to communicate. He's going to talk with God about what's going on. And he's going to hope in God no matter what. David also wrote, I wait for the Lord, my soul waits, and in his word I hope. The grounds of our hope in God are what he has promised, what he has revealed to us in the Bible. In his word I hope. And he goes on in Psalm 146 to say, how blessed is he whose help is the God of Jacob, whose hope is in the Lord his God. You want to be blessed? You want to experience blessing? There is the only way to experience it. Put your hope in the right direction, in the original, in the God, the Creator, the one who is immortal. Put your hope in God, and you will be blessed. And this is our hope in the New Testament, too. Peter mentions that in his first epistle. You, through him, are believers, you speaking through Jesus, are believers in God who raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and hope are in God. Our faith and hope are in Jesus, who is God. And as we trust and hope in him, to make us right, to give us eternal life. God, who raised Jesus from the dead and gave him glory, will also raise us from the dead and give us glory. That's God's promise. That's our hope. Verse 8, he explains his hope a little more. What exactly is he hoping God will do? Verse 8, from all my transgressions, rescue me. Don't put me in the situation of being the stigma of a fool. David recognizes how bad the position, he is in. His transgressions of God's law have put him in the position of being subject to God's wrath and punishment, to being scorned and made fun of and treated like an outcast by foolish people who say there is no God and who merely judge the world by outward appearances and worldly success. David's only hope is for God to rescue or deliver him from his transgressions by forgiving him and showing loving kindness to him, so that not only will his soul be saved, which will be good enough, but also as when the world sees him saved, rescued, the empty people of the world will see there's something substantial to God and his salvation. David continues in verse 9, I was shut up, I did not open my mouth because it was you who acted. If God is the force behind what happens in your life, and if he is truly God and not just another man that we can judge and criticize, then it would behoove us to keep our mouth shut and not complain so much at the things we don't like in life. We can talk to God about it, but complaining to God is not what God is really wanting to hear. And in this case, David felt like he had to keep his mouth shut, because otherwise he would complain and be offensive to God. We see other saints in the Bible who did something similar earlier probably in David's life, when Shimei cursed and threw rocks at David while David was escaping from Absalom's takeover of Jerusalem. David said, let him curse. If he curses, if the Lord told him to curse me, who can say why? Just let him do it. I'm not going to say anything about this. Just let him curse. Maybe the Lord has told him to do so. Job, when his wife saw how sick he was, how destitute he had become, lost everything, his wife suggested that he curse God. And in Job 2:10, Job said, you speak as one of the foolish women speak. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity? He was willing to accept and not complain about what God was doing in his life at the time. And it says in all this, Job did not sin then. Eli the priest is another person who kept his mouth shut. God fired him from the priesthood for his negligence, raised up Samuel in his place, and then sends this, 5-7-year-old boy to give him the message, you're fired, and I'm taking over. That would be hard to hear if you were an old, experienced priest, and this little boy comes up and says, you're fired, I'm taking over for you. But Eli said, it is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him. Now, I think Eli was a little too fatalistic in his response, and maybe could have done a better job of responding, but at least he didn't bellyache and complain to God, oh God, you're so unfair. He had indeed been negligent. As mortal creatures, we have no right to criticize God about what he's doing. We must treat him with utmost respect. However, we can and should ask him respectfully for mercy and redemption. We can and should talk to him and request interventions. And that's what David does in these next few verses. One request he gives is, divert your scourge from upon me. Because as for me, I'm finished as a result of the hostility of your hand. Job said some similar things. Remove your hand from me, this disciplining hand, pounding him down. Let not the dread of you terrify me. Let him remove his rod from me that is chastising him. Let not dread of him terrifying me. It's important to recognize, however, how it is that this request can be made. This is not a request to... This is not saying, God, you're unfair. I didn't do anything that bad. I don't deserve to be punished. Leave me alone. That's not the attitude. That's not the theology behind this request. What's going on behind this request is explained in Isaiah 53. And it's the substitutionary atonement of the Messiah. Using the same word, scourge, God said of the Messiah in Isaiah 53, surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities, and the chastisement for our peace was upon him. And by his stripes we are healed. That is how David the transgressor could ask God to remove his punishing hand. God would divert those strokes coming upon David and put them upon Jesus instead. That is the theology behind David's request. David understood this because every morning and every evening he saw a lamb slaughtered and offered up on the altar while people asked God to forgive them of their sins. They understood that a substitute was coming who would take upon himself the guilt of their sins and die instead of them and satisfy God's justice as a result, leaving God's people free of guilt and right with God. And so that's what's behind him saying, turn away your punishment. That it would be justly inflicted upon me. Let it fall upon Jesus and let Jesus save me. Verse 11. With reproofs over iniquity that you discipline man. It is with reproofs over iniquity that you discipline man. And you, like the moth, dissolve what he desires. Every man is, in fact, puny. God is superior to man when it comes about to bringing justice. God will identify and speak up about everything that we do wrong. He will bring it up as an accusation against us on that judgment day. We will all stand before the judgment seat of Christ and give an account for every deed done in our body, whether good or bad, wrote the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians 5. There will be a day in court where we're going to... Where God will be able to prove every accusation beyond shadow of a doubt and condemn us and hold us guilty as charged. God does not leave the guilty unpunished. He doesn't miss a thing. God also has the power to execute punishment, either chastening them so that they'll repent or penalizing them ultimately for their sin. Sometimes God does that by taking away things that we desire, the things that we delight in. In Isaiah 44, he mentioned these things that they delight in, calls them idols. and says they're no profit to them, and their own idols are going to be used as testimony against them. You have broken my law that says you shall have no other gods before me, and you stand condemned, worthy of death. Hebrews 12 speaks of the chastening. God doesn't ignore the sins in his own people's lives either. But God's action in our lives is that of helping us deal with and weed out sins that are offensive to him. And so he brings chastening as a way of helping us recognize, oh, I'm doing wrong, and I need to repent of this and become free of this impediment to my relationship with God. Hebrews 12 talks about that. Verse 5, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you're rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives. If God scourges you, it's because he accepts you and considers you his child. It's something that we can welcome and welcome as a process of helping us realize new ways that we have done wrong and start dealing with them and repenting of them. Often God chastens by consuming or dissolving away idols in your life that have gotten too precious to you. For those of us as we age, it can be our idolatry of our image of beauty or handsomeness starts to sag over time. Maybe it's some wealth or prestige that you used to have but you lost. That was part of God's chastening in your life. He took that thing away so that it wouldn't distract you. Or maybe it's a person or a thing that you loved in your life, and God took that person away or that pet away or whatever that was precious to you in order to draw your attention back to God, because you've been paying too much attention to that boyfriend or girlfriend or that pet or I don't know what other thing, your car or whatever it was God took away from you. That is part of God's chastening process. God has the power to do whatever it takes to work with humans to sanctify them. He compares himself to a moth in verse 11. The moth is used in some other places to describe God's consuming judgment. In Job 13, he said his body was decaying like a moth-eaten garment. Isaiah talks about the ungodly being consumed like moths eat wool. I've had, pretty recently, reached into the back of my closet in the wintertime, pull out that red wool Christmas sweater, and man, there's a hole in it. Moth got to it. And it's in this sense that God compares himself to a moth in Hosea 5:12, bringing decay, dissolving things that were precious to them. I think one reason, and I don't take credit for this, I'm trying to remember who it was. I think it was John Calvin that commented on this one, that it seems a little odd that God would compare himself to a moth. You might expect him to say, like a T-Rex, he destroys what stands in the way between you and him. T-Rex might be a little more impressive, but the moth's work is a little more hidden. It's that thing that, you don't recognize it until, the next season. It's like, whoa, what happened? God's judgments often don't come suddenly and publicly. The ungodly generally don't get struck by lightning bolts, but rather they experience a slower but just as deadly corruption of their hearts and minds and bodies. And once again, at the end of verse 11, man is puny compared to God. He's vanity. He's a mere breath. And therefore, our respect for this God should be great. James 4 says, "Come now, you who say today or tomorrow, we'll go to such and such a city and spend a year there and buy and sell and make a profit. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It's even a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that." Showing respect to God and recognizing that we are a derivative creation of Him and He is the source of our life. And then if I live tomorrow, it's because God has given me that next day, that one more hand breadth. And I thank God for that. Verse 12 gives a couple more requests for intervention, for God to intervene, not just stoically accepting the fate of being punished by God, but actively asking for God's redemption and intervention. "Please listen to my prayer, Yahweh. Please give ear to my hollering or my crying for help. Do not give me the silent treatment in response to my tears, because I am a visitor with you, a tenant like all my forefathers were." This is a position of humility. He's meekly acknowledging that he doesn't have control of the situation. He doesn't own the world. He's a tenant. And he's not going to be around long. I'm just a visitor. He also is acknowledging his dependency upon God. I'm a guest. He's politely asking God to respond to him with salvation. He says, "Please listen." There's a paragogic noon that I think is indicating respect. A respectful request here. "Please give ear." There's the na suffix on that verb that is part of a polite request. It's showing respect to God and His words. David uses two words to express his dependency and mortality. Ger is one of them. I translated that visitor. And Toshav from the That's not the right. The word after tenant in Hebrews is not correct. I don't know how that got in there. It's from the yeshav to settle, to dwell, that root meaning. Most versions translate these words stranger and sojourner. I suggest that if David had meant strange or alien, he would have used a different Hebrew word, zur, which has a root meaning of strangeness or foreignness, if that was his focus. But I think what he's focusing on here is a little different, and that has to do with being a guest. A visitor or a tenant is in a dependent relationship upon his host. Saying that he's a temporary resident in God's world is recognizing that God is his host, then God is his master. That's why he calls him my master. David is at God's mercy. I think that's what he's communicating here. David is modeling for us an appeal that's based upon God's mercy for mortals. In God's eyes, even the towners who've lived in Manhattan for decades are still temporary residents. In Leviticus, he said he owns the land, so we're just aliens and sojourners who use his land. 1 Peter 2:11, "Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul." And we also saw those words show up in Hebrews 11 that Peter read. Strangers and exiles. That was the attitude and the understanding of the relationship in which they lived on in this world. We're not going to act like we own our own property. We're merely tenants on God's land. That means we're responsible to Him to use it for His glory. But it also means we are privileged to ask for His help. A renter, when I was renting apartments and something broke, I didn't have to fix it. I just called the landlord, hey, come fix this. And it was his responsibility to fix because he was the landlord. I was just the tenant. Now that I supposedly own my own house, if something breaks, I have to fix it myself because I'm the owner. Both of these things both of these things in the way David is communicating with God. There's both responsibility. I am a creature, and I'm going to treat God with respect because He is my master. But there's also the role of privilege. I see a need, and I'm going to call the master in to deal with it because he can, because he is the master. And I'm on his team. I'm one of his servants. And help he will when we ask. Psalm 18, David said, during my distress, I would call upon the Lord. Even to God, I would holler or call for help. And from his temple, he would hear my voice. And my hollering would get to his attention, into his ears. He does hear, and he will respond. Psalm 56:8, you've taken account of my wanderings. You've put my tears into your bottle. Are they not recorded in your book? Our tears will not be ignored. Express them to God. And use that privilege status to call Him to intervene and bring redemption. In the final verse, there's this one more request. There we go. Halt the investigation of me, and let me flash a smile before I go and I'm no longer around. The first word, verse 13, to stop, turn away, needs to be understood in the context of this psalm. David's not asking God to stop paying any attention to him or to stop loving him. The context of this psalm, of course, is David is in pain. He's being scourged. He's getting a spanking. He's under discipline. He's getting reproof. He's being told, you're doing wrong. It's this fault-finding and punishing process that David is asking God to bring a halt to and turn away from. He wants God to put the investigation under wraps, forgive him of his sins, spare him from the punishment he deserves. Psalm 130, he said, if you, O Lord, should mark iniquities, who could stand? But there is forgiveness with you, that you may be feared. Your chastening, your justice is not something that I as a human can possibly bear. Therefore, I ask you for your forgiveness, ask you to make me right, and then I respect you because you are my master and my Savior. I wait for the Lord. My soul waits in His word, I hope, His promises of salvation. David's final request can seem a little bit impatient, or disrespectful even. But again, he's following the example of Job, who made similar statements. For the sake of time, I won't read them all, but you can see them on the screen from Job 7:19, Job 10:20, and Job 14:6. It's still relating to God as a humble mortal, saying, in effect, in my human condition, I'm too frail. I could not stand to know all my sins. And I'm too feeble to pay for all my sins. So please, in wrath, remember mercy. Have mercy upon me, Lord. Please don't discipline me in your wrath. Please be merciful to me. And God will respond with his salvation. He loves that kind of prayer. He loves that kind of humility before him, that kind of getting on the same page with him, abhorring sin and desiring for God's salvation. He loves that and responds with his salvation to those who have that attitude. So how should a mortal relate to the immortal God? Especially in light of the fact that we are all sinners who have offended that God. Should I try to talk to him? Absolutely. He will listen. He's promised that he will. You don't have to keep your mouth shut unless you absolutely can't stop yourself from saying something blasphemous. Talk with God about the problems that you're seeing and call in his help to redeem. Can I find out what he's talking or doing or thinking? Absolutely. He's not silent towards those of us who trust him. He said that. We have his words in the Bible. We have a spirit within us, and he will reveal himself to us. Can I negotiate with him? Absolutely. Remember early on, Abraham negotiating with the angel of the Lord and his cohorts over the destruction of the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. If there are 50 righteous people in there, will you not destroy it? What if they're just 15? Will you not? What if they're just 5? He haggled with God, and God enjoyed it. God wanted him to do that. God was the one that said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? No, I'm going to let him know so that he does ask for my intervention to bring redemption." God does not expect us to simply passively endure the inevitable ravages of our sin. He wants us to team up with him to bring redemption into this fallen world. We can absolutely ask for forgiveness and mercy, not only for ourselves, but for others, and deliverance from the full consequences of sin. There will be still some consequences we face. And over all this, what attitude should we have in our communication with God, in our negotiations with God? It needs to be the attitude of humility. I am a creature derived from your image. And I'm puny. I'm nothing compared to you. I'm not God. I have just a tiny lifespan compared to your eternity. I'm the servant. You're the master. I will wait for you, not make you wait for me. I'm a guest, a tenant on your property. I'm dependent upon you, and so I will ask for your mercy. And I will trust him to generously give me what I ask.